From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Soldotna's Indy Walton has resigned from his seat on the State Board of Fisheries, the seven-member board that makes decisions about fish allocations and management in Alaska's waters. Walton says he's dealing with a confluence of health issues that have been exacerbated by stress and a bout of COVID-19. While he thought he could balance those issues when he accepted Governor Mike Dunleavy's nomination in September, he says he's since had to reconsider.
I'd hoped when I accepted the position that things would be different and change as far as my schedule, and didn't realize some of the health issues that I was being faced with until after doing some tests. And I know now I've got to alleviate some of the stress and lighten my load a little bit, which isn't my style.
He says his workload is another factor. Walton is a financial advisor to the Soldotna branch of Edward Jones. Walton's resignation caps a four-month tenure on the board. The Cordova Times first reported Dunleavy appointed Walton to the seventh open seat last fall after his previous nominee was rejected by the Alaska legislature. Walton lives in Soldotna and has roots in both the commercial and sport fishing sectors. He owns a sport fishing lodge in Igiagig and commercial fishes in Bristol Bay. He's also an outspoken critic of the controversial Pebble Mine project. In his time on the board, Walton attended one work session in Anchorage. He says he's frustrated he has to take a step back from the board now, and he might consider pursuing the position again if his situation changes down the road. In the meantime, he hopes whoever takes his place can bring experience from multiple sectors.
I would love to see somebody who has an open mind that can try to bring, you know, both sides of the commercial and sport side of fishing together to work out some of the impasses that are currently, you know, at bay.
Board of Fisheries Executive Director Glenn Haight says Dunleavy has 30 days to make a new appointment to the board. His office is now accepting applications for the three-year position. Separately, the board's next meeting, scheduled for January in Ketchikan, has been postponed due to high COVID-19 case counts in southeast Alaska.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Alaska has over half the coastline in the entire United States, 6,640 miles of coastline. This number is especially important for Alaska's fisheries managers because the area they manage extends from the coast to 200 miles out to sea. This means the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has jurisdiction over 900,000 square miles of ocean. It was not always the case that countries had jurisdiction over waters off their shores. In 1608, the Dutch scholar Hugo Grotius promoted the concept of an ocean under the jurisdiction of no nation, where the traditional uses, navigation and fishing, were absolutely unrestricted. And in the 3.5 centuries that followed, the nations of the world did indeed sail in law-free high seas. Every nation's territorial sea belt of 3 to 4 miles offshore was generally accepted as sovereign. This was because that was the range of cannons back in the day. But otherwise, conventional wisdom was that the nations of the earth could never agree on a universal maritime code. This changed rapidly in modern times as a reaction to two factors. The first was the realization that great mineral wealth might lie beneath the continental shelves of the world. The second was the modernization of fishing fleets and their increased ability to extract significant amounts of fish far from their home ports. In 1945, President Truman issued two proclamations that well expressed a change in the way nations were thinking about their marine resources. One proclamation claimed exclusive mineral and hydrocarbon rights on the continental shelf, and the second claimed the right to develop fishery conservation programs in adjacent seas. Other nations followed suit with a hodgepodge of often contradictory regulations. Then in 1971, Kenya introduced the idea of an exclusive economic zone that would give each nation control of all its offshore economic activities, whether in the water column or the seabed. Between 1973 and 1982, the United Nations developed its Convention on the Law of the Sea, which established a universal exclusive economic zone that extends 200 miles from the coastline of every nation, but preserved freedom of navigation for all vessels. In 1976, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act was passed in the United States to take advantage of our nation's expanded jurisdiction. Before MSA, foreign fleets could fish as close as 12 miles offshore. The 8 new U.S. regional fishery management councils directed their attention to enabling the Americanization of our fisheries, and they were very successful. But by 1996, many U.S. fisheries were depleted, and Congress passed a revision to MSA called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, which refocused its goals toward conservation, stock rebuilding, and ecosystem protection. The Sustainable Fisheries Act included 10 national standards by which all U.S. fish laws are meant to be judged. If the MSA is the constitution of American fishery regulation, then the national standards are its constitutional amendments. In a recent debate over halibut bycatch, we saw two national standards butt heads. National Standard 9 requires managers to minimize bycatch and bycatch mortality, quote, to the extent practicable, close quote. National Standard 1 requires managers to prevent overfishing while achieving optimum yield. The optimum yield is the yield that achieves the greatest overall benefit to the nation, particularly with respect to food production and recreational opportunities. Basically, it's maximum sustainable yield minus considerations. What you may now ask is maximum sustainable yield. Maximum sustainable yield is the amount of fish you can remove from a fishery and still be able to remove the same amount the next season and the season after that. It's the maximum yield that can be sustained over time. Optimum yield starts with maximum sustainable yield, then reduces it by any relevant social, economic, or ecological factor. National Standard 1 asks managers to achieve optimum yield while preventing overfishing. But which goal is the trump card? The courts will likely be the place where these questions are answered. In the case of NRDC versus Daly in 2000, regarding National Standard 1, the court determined, quote, where two alternatives achieve similar conservation goals, the alternative that minimizes the adverse impacts on fishing communities would be preferred, close quote. However, it also notes, quote, the government concedes and we agree that under the Fishery Act, the service, that is the National Marine Fishery Service, must give priority to conservation measures. It is only when two different plans achieve similar conservation measures that the service takes into consideration adverse economic consequences. In the case of halibut bycatch allocations to the Amendment 80 fleet of large catcher processors, the Fishery Management Council is charged both with enabling optimum yield for a fleet that produces millions of pounds of food and minimizing the bycatch of non-target halibut. They chose to link bycatch allowances with halibut abundance, with the likely result that the Amendment 80 fleet will fall far short of maximum sustainable yield for target species. As the national standards continue to scrape up against each other like tectonic plates, the future undoubtedly holds more tough decisions for fishery managers.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund in recognition of the fishing industry, which provides over 58,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
Last week, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced it's postponing the upcoming Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting due to coronavirus concerns. The Board of Fish is the group that makes policy decisions around state-managed fisheries. It was set to kick off its 12-day Southeast Shellfish and Finfish meeting in Ketchikan on January 4th. According to an AD/FNG press release, the meeting was postponed due to the sharp increase of COVID-19 cases throughout the United States and in Southeast Alaska. The Southeast meeting, which happens on a three-year cycle, had already been postponed more than once. Last spring, the Board of Fish postponed all in-person meetings due to COVID-19. According to the release, key staff had already tested positive for COVID and were unable to participate in the meeting. The board estimated that at least 200 people would attend the meeting from around the state, and a gathering that large has the potential to cause, quote, a significant case spike in Ketchikan. Under the advice of healthcare professionals who helped the board to develop its COVID mitigation plan, they decided to cancel. The board has not set a new date and location for the postponed meeting.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. For more information, call 1-907-235-4966 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice-weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.